to the Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. This is Air America Radio.
And greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. An awful lot of news to cover today. I want to give you a take on Alberto Gonzalez and what's up there. There is, I think, a huge element of, well, actually, there's a huge story that's not being reported, that's being completely ignored. And to a certain extent, that has to do with how and what's going on in the media. We want to get into that as we get through our program today as well, too. The self-censorship of the media, the strange behavior of the media with regard to this, a variety of other issues. The whole impeachment thing, please don't throw me in that briar patch, says Karl Rove. And, of course, life and death issues, which is where we begin our first hour. Well, the Supreme Court last week talking about the so-called partial birth abortion ban. I want to share with you some thoughts on that as we continue. DNA is now going to clear the 200th person. We'll get to that in just a minute. But to begin the whole issue of life and death, Anthony Adams is on the line with us. He's a Republican assemblyman in California. He's from Assembly District 59. Republican.assembly.ca.gov is the website. And Representative, is it Representative Adams? Is that the proper way to address an assemblyman? No? Sir?
Yes.
Hey, I'm sorry. I took a second there for Clay to pot you up. Is how do I appropriately address an assemblyman? I'm sorry, I'm not a resident of California.
A member of the assembly is generally referred to just as assemblyman, but please feel free to call me Anthony.
Oh, okay, great. Well, thank you, Anthony. Here in Oregon, where I live, I'm broadcasting from the People's Republic of Portland, and we've had physician-assisted suicide for some time in this state. Your state is considering it, and you are quite concerned about that. You want to tell us why?
Sure. To my way of thinking, this is a morality issue. There's an awful lot of folks who want to characterize this as a debate about choice and as a debate about whether or not this has a cost-benefit analysis, whether it's pragmatic to do this. But I think that is inappropriately couched. I think that to the degree that we empower physicians the ability to prescribe life-ending medications, I think we step beyond a choice issue and cross over a morality line that I'm not willing to cross.
Well, I agree with you that it's a morality issue. You know, having watched people die miserable and painful and protracted deaths for lack of the ability to quickly terminate their own lives, I think that's a terrible thing. We had a dog, for example, that we had for 19 years, Sabra, and finally she reached the point where she was blind, deaf, and couldn't get up and was soiling her own bed. And at that point, and she was badly arthritic, and at that point, finally, her quality of life was so bad and she was whimpering in pain all the time that we took her to the vet and the vet put her down. What is wrong with an aware, conscious individual who two doctors have said this person will be dead in 6 months, period, there's no way around it, who is in severe pain, choosing to end their own lives in a way that is painless with the help of a physician?
Well, first of all, thank you for the opportunity to address that. But before I engage in that question directly, I wanted to just to briefly touch on your analogy. Comparing an animal to a human being, in my mind, is vastly different.
I agree. What I'm saying is we treat our animals better than we do our humans.
Well, that's because we presuppose, number one, the lack of a soul in our animals so that there is no greater moral issue. And secondly, I think that we have a responsibility to attend to the needs of those that we're called to be stewards over.
So why should we torment souls? I mean, I watched my father barfing blood and gasping for breath for 10 hours before he finally died. He was in excruciating pain, and it was just absolutely wrong. And I know him well enough to know that had he had the ability, I mean, he was frozen, he had stroked out, but had he the ability to say, end it now, he certainly would have.
Right. No question about it that pain and suffering is a horrible condition. I mean, I think it's Immanuel Kant talks about the fact that we don't fear death at all. We fear the pain of death. And unquestionably, we don't want to see anyone suffer. But I think that we become so consumed in this nation, and particularly in our two states where we're either you have it or we're debating the matter, we become so obsessive about the physical body that we are wholly willing to reject the spiritual one. And we suggest that we can cross that spiritual line because there's physical impediments. Well, Bible suggests to you that all through life we have pain, we have suffering, we have horrible degradation, we have people who are consistently humiliated at the hands of other human beings, but that is not a qualifier for taking a life.
But if the soul survives death, let's assume for a moment that the soul is real.
Okay.
And you know, I believe. I mean, as a Christian, I believe that. But you know, for the sake of argument, because we could also argue it, you know, in a context that's totally a-religious, and I think we probably should as well. But let's assume for a moment that the soul actually does make some sort of continuous transition after life. If that's the case, then why should we inflict horrible, painful misery on that soul?
Well, that's just it. Are we doing that on the soul or are we doing it on the body? The soul is, if in the context of this discussion where we've mutually agreed that
on
the
that
soul
person.
Is dead, right.
On that person.
On that person. We are not inflicting it. And I think that's the misnomer.
So you don't think that the soul has anything to do with consciousness?
You know, that's a very difficult question to answer with any kind of a surety.
Does this come down ultimately, Assemblyman Adams, to your religious belief or that of the people that you are representing?
It does.
That this is ultimately suicide and that suicide is a sin?
It does, yes. Well, no.
Okay.
Yes, it does that it comes down to that moral issue. On the question of whether suicide is a sin or not, we sin all the time. The government's place is not to preclude.
No, but suicide
sin.
Is a mortal sin. I mean, the Catholic Church says suicide is a mortal sin that will prevent you from getting into heaven.
I'm not a Catholic myself. I don't hold to that
belief. Well, many Protestants hold that belief
right.
as well.
But to the degree that I don't hold that belief, I would suggest to you only that you know, right now a person has the free will to take their lives, and I know that we speak oftentimes about that our rare exception when a person is horribly debilitated and doesn't have that capacity, but within the context of this discussion, a person has the right to take their own life, and in as much as they have the right to commit any sin, basically, the question is not do they have the right to commit a sin per se, but does the state of California, does the state of Oregon have the right to empower a physician to take another's life, even if it's
the physician actually doesn't do it. The physician does not take the person's
life. You're right in the sense that the physician prescribes the medication and the patient will take it. But I would I would suggest to you that is nothing more than just a vicarious taking, a vicarious murder.
Actually, it's a profound difference. I do a local program on here on AM 620 KPOJ in Portland before I do this national program. And over the last 2 years that I've been doing that program, I've interviewed a number of physicians, and there's over 1,400 of them in this state who are licensed to prescribe life-ending medications. To a person, and we have looked for the other side of the story aggressively.
Right.
100% of them have said that what they find is that when they prescribe life-ending medication to people, those people very, very rarely use it, A, and B, suddenly go from a state of high anxiety and panic to a state of relaxation. They sit usually it's secanol or you know, one of the very high doses of one of the barbiturates. So you take
right.
the pill and you basically fall asleep and never wake up again. And the person will set that on the bed next to them and say, okay, now I know that anytime I want to go, I can go, so I can just relax about that. And now I think I'll just wait another hour. And I'll wait another hour. And I can put up with this pain for another 2 hours. And I can put up with this for another day. And the vast majority of the people who are prescribed this medication never end up using it. And in fact, these physicians are of the opinion that these are people who otherwise, in a panic, would have probably, you know, gotten a pistol and blown their brains out.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because in light of the fact that we just had this debate here in California, there was an awful lot of dialogue from the proponents of assisted suicide concerning the data coming out of Oregon. And in fact, of the 450 prescriptions that were issued last year or issued previously for assisted suicide and an ending of life, half actually took it, half did not. So I think that's a little bit more than the small minority. I think you're talking about half doing so. But I don't know if that necessarily attributes, you know, a point to either one of our arguments. I think, but just as a clarification, half did actually choose to take it.
I'm interesting. I have the data and the data analysis here.
And this was from the proponents of assisted suicide. This was my extrapolation of the data, rather what they were purporting.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, you're right. I'm looking at this. So we have people here. I see that as a good thing. I see that as, you know, people who are in intractable pain, they're going to die anyway. Why go to the point where the pain is unbearable? And why not just end it now?
That's exactly.
Wouldn't you like to have that power to make that decision for yourself?
Well, indeed I would, but not at the expense of asking somebody to take that secondary step beyond me. See, you and I fundamentally disagree that there is no there's no genuine nexus between a physician giving you medication to kill yourself and a physician directly taking your life, per se. I think that there is. I think that that's a big deal, and I think that actually exists, and I think by removing it one step away, that doesn't preclude or excuse what I
believe. So you'd rather have people have access to a handgun but not to barbiturates?
Well, I would certainly never, never condone the use of any instrumentality of, you know,
16 minutes past
the hour. Purposes of taking one's life.
I'm sorry, sir, we're out of time.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
Condescend me, 'cause I know the Bible too, and I bet I'll get to heaven just as quick as you. I asked for my ticket so I could be on my way, and as I walked out the door, I heard the lady say, "Thou shalt not kill helpless children in some crazy war somewhere. Thou shalt not kill by injection, gas chamber, or the chair. Thou shalt not kill with poison water or polluted air. Thou shalt not kill."
Yeah, that's the true pro-life movement. Anyway, this is an issue that is going to be hot in California. It's going to be hot all across the United States. Here in Oregon, the citizens of Oregon passed an initiative, 51% in favor, in November of 1994, providing for what's called the Oregon Death with Dignity Act, which is physician-assisted suicide. That is to say that if you are within 6 months of dying, and you can find two physicians who will certify that you are and that you qualify for this, then one of those physicians will prescribe you an overdose of barbiturates, which you can then set on the table next to your bed and use if or when you decide. And about half of the people who get these never use them. They die of natural causes, or they die of their disease. And actually, I think that that's a pretty startling statistic in and of itself, because they went through all that effort and all that hassle to get that stuff, and half of them didn't even use it. But this raises this whole issue of death and dying and life and all of this, and whether we're going to contaminate our political dialogue with a religious agenda. You know, I may believe that suicide is a sin, and I may believe that the soul survives life, but that doesn't mean that I think that the state has any right to legislate that. And if the fact of the matter is that we all have a right to commit suicide and, you know, try to stop somebody if they're really bent on it, then shouldn't people have a way to do it in a way that has some counseling associated with it, that helps talk them down off the wall, that reduces the probability that they're going to do it by half, in the case here in Oregon of physician-assisted suicide, and that does it in a way that doesn't leave a horrible mess? My best friend Clark killed himself when we were teenagers after he went into the Army during the Vietnam War, and shot himself in the head, left a terrible mess, and this doesn't, and it's well, not that that's, I mean, that's the aesthetic, it's not that's, I just say that as it had a horrible emotional impact on all of us who saw him after he had died, who were there, who arrived shortly after he committed suicide. That shouldn't have to be. That shouldn't have to happen. I mean, people should be able to die peacefully when they really choose to die. Now, I'm not suggesting that somebody, you know, like Clark, who was just depressed, should even have access to physician-assisted suicide. I'm not in favor of that. But somebody who is 6 months away from dying from a disease, and the majority of the people who use this, by the way, are people with ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, or AIDS, and they are in terrible pain. the greatest impact, this from the Frequently Asked Questions on deathwithdignity.org, provided by the Oregon Department of Human Services. The greatest impact of the Oregon Death with Dignity law may lie in the peace of mind it provides those who will never use it, but who know that it is an available choice. Many more legal lethal prescriptions are requested under the law than are used. So I just put that in context. At the same time, we are aggressively killing people in the United States. And big story on the front cover of today's USA Today, the 200th person this week, a former Army cook who has already spent 25 years in prison for a crime he did not commit, will be the 200th person to be released from jail after the Innocence Project has proved that he did not do the crime. 1992 to 2002, the Innocence Project took 10 years to chronicle their first 100 people. Now it's their second 100 people has taken them only, 4 years? I mean, they're getting better at this, and the DNA technology is far more available. 5 years ago, people said the number of exonerations were going to dry up because there weren't that many wrongful convictions, says lawyer Barry Scheck, the co-founder of the Innocence Project in 1992. But clearly, there are plenty of innocent persons still in prison. There's no way you can look at this data without believing that. So we have that. And then the United States Supreme Court's decision on abortion. I just want to lay this down. In my opinion, what the core argument of this decision, this 5-4 decision, was that women are too fragile to receive medical treatment, and they need the care and guidance of men, particularly men who run government. And this is the subtext of the laws that are being passed that say that they must look at a sonogram, et cetera, et cetera. It's all about, oh, you poor thing, you're dumb, you're incapable, you're incompetent. We'll take care of you. It's patronizing. It's horrible. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
6:34 past the hour. Ruth Bader Ginsburg really nailed this abortion thing solidly. I just want to wrap this all. I see this as part of, frankly, all one giant thing, which is the whole conservative morality thing is about what we do in private, and liberal morality is about what we do in public. And you'll find this repeated over and over and over again. The conservatives want to insert themselves into your bedroom. They want to insert themselves into women's wombs. They want to insert themselves into the room in which you are dying. They want to insert themselves into your hospital room. They want to insert themselves into your medical procedures. They want their corporations to control what you do and don't have access to with regard to health care. And on it goes. Liberals, on the other hand, say that stuff is all private. However, if there are hungry among us, if there are homeless among us, if there are sick among us in the public, then we cannot call ourselves a moral people. And if there are dying among us in intractable agony, we cannot call ourselves a moral people. And if a woman is carrying a fetus that it turns out is going to die or is dying or is profoundly disfigured and not not going to be viable outside the womb, or represents a significant threat to her health, then whatever technique is necessary to remove that fetus so that her life can continue should be legal, safe, and available. In her dissent, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, in her dissent against this so-called partial birth, this D&E extraction opinion of the Supreme Court, in which the five Catholics voted to uphold this 2003 law that the Republicans passed through the House and Senate and Bush signed, the so-called partial birth abortion law. In Ruth Bader Ginsburg's dissent, she recalibrated the entire argument. She pointed out that Roe v. Wade was based on privacy, the Fourth Amendment. But she argued that there was something more important here, an issue more important here, and that's equal rights. That women should have the equal power with men to make decisions about their bodies and what's going on in their bodies. That this has to do with equal rights. And frankly, I think that this argument, Cass Sunstein, who is absolutely one of my favorite authors in the entire planet and a professor at the University of Chicago Law School, Cass Sunstein's writings on Franklin Roosevelt are brilliant. One of his books is one of my recommended books of the month over at BuzzFlash.com. Cass Sunstein wrote an op-ed in the L.A. Times last week in which he said the paternalistic ground, he pointed out that he's characterizing Ginsburg's dissent. And he says the paternalistic ground that women might turn out to regret their choices or are too fragile to receive all relevant information about medical possibilities is the context of this. In her view, in Ginsburg's view, such paternalistic arguments run afoul of the guarantee of sex equality because they reflect, and now this is quoting from the Supreme Court decision by the five Catholic males in the majority, quote, ancient notions about women's place in the family and under the Constitution, ideas that have long been since discredited. Excuse me, I'm sorry. This is quoting from an article that Ginsburg wrote in 1985 in a law review article that characterizing the behavior of the five male Catholics in the court. The sex equality argument, says Sunstein, has considerable advantages over the privacy argument. And this whole thing, I mean, this is all about a woman's proper place and whether women are the property of men. And you know, the whole consent of the father and all this stuff, this all ties into this paternalistic notion that has been so ascendant in our culture for so long. And we thought we had started to knock down in the 1970s and is now rearing its ugly head again. And it's that paternalistic notion of young lady or woman or whatever, if you're going to have an abortion, you're going to have a conversation with us first. Sick and dying person, if you want to die, we're going to prevent that from happening. And we're going to make a lot of money in the process, by the way, by keeping you alive. I mean, there's an entire industry devoted to that. This is all, frankly, in my opinion, part of the same fabric. Dave in Las Vegas, Nevada. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Same old story here. Here it is, coming up on 2010, and we're dealing with the morality issues that are being hung over us from the medieval ages. We've got a patriarchal society that wants to continue to enforce its moralistic viewpoints via conservative theologians that want to keep us from helping prevent suffering. They'd rather see the suffering and justify it through their warped sense of duty to God and country rather than actual stop it.
I think that there's a Calvinist notion here, Dave, and thank you for making the point that somehow because we are all born sinful in that worldview and that somehow sin purges pain purges sin, that by forcing people to experience excruciating pain at the end of life, somehow you're purifying them for the next step or something like that. You know, it may work for Opus Dei where they put the cinch on their leg and whip themselves, but I'm sorry, I don't want it for me. Thank you very much. And I like living in a state where I know that if I'm really in bad shape, I can say, okay, see you guys all later on my own terms. I can gather my family around. I can say goodbye. I can tell people what I have to say at the end of my life. I can pop a couple of pills, and 4 hours later, I'm not there anymore. Laurie in San Diego, California. Hey, Laurie.
Hey, Tom. I just want to say that I am so fed up with this growing acceptance of religious belief as fact in public political debates. You know, my question.
I agree.
My question for your guest would have been, I don't believe in worshiping the Bible. I don't believe in worshiping Jesus Christ. I don't believe in souls. I don't believe in heaven and hell. I don't believe in mortal sins or an afterlife. So if you take all of that out of his argument, what is it?
Right. So why should his beliefs be imposed on you, or my beliefs for that matter? And I'm suggesting that my beliefs shouldn't be imposed on you. He's suggesting that his beliefs should be imposed on you. And you make your point very, very well, Laurie. Thank you very much. Keith in Queens, New York. Hey, Keith.
Oh, good morning. I just want to say, as opposite of the young lady that just spoke, I believe in Jesus Christ. I believe, I don't worship the Bible, I worship God. But I believe that this is a, you know, a person should have a choice and be made aware of that there's choices as to, you know, what if there's an afterlife or not. And if they want to take their life, then that's on them. But I don't think government should enforce that, you know, make this a rule or. It's up to a person.
No, nobody's talking about the government. We're not talking about euthanasia here, Keith. We're not talking about the government killing people. What we're talking about is a person who has been diagnosed by two different doctors as being so terminally ill that within 60 days, within 6 months at the most, within 6 months, they will be dead. And there is a mitigating circumstance on top of that, like they're in incredible pain. And if you can get two doctors to certify that, then one of those doctors can prescribe them an overdose of barbiturates, which they themselves can then take whenever they want to or not. And half of all the people who get those drugs don't ever take them. They die of their disease.
Well, last September 2006, I lost my father to cancer. He was diagnosed with it, and 5 weeks later, he was dead. And at one point, I'm not going to mention the hospital, was trying to force my mother and my sister and I to make a decision as to pull the plug. Being as Christians, we believe that if it's his time to die, God will take him naturally. Be it if we pull a plug if he lives on, or if we, but, you know, it's the person's choice. But they got to know that, you know, there's other, they should have like a psychologist there to explain to them, or a priest there to explain to them, well, this is what we believe in, you know, it's up to you.
If that's their thing, if psychology is their religion, if Catholicism or Protestantism is their religion, if rationalism is their you know, primary belief structure, whatever. Interesting point, Keith. Thank you. Jack in San Diego. Hey, Jack, what's up?
Well, Tom, there's a plan to legalize first-term abortion in Mexico, and you can imagine it's meeting with a lot of protests. In fact,
yes.
Catholic bishops have threatened legislators, doctors, and women with excommunication.
Yes, I've been watching that in the paper.
Well, here's what I want to bring up is that, and if you can confirm this, I have heard that the five Supreme Court justices that ruled on this late-term abortion issue, that they're all Catholic. And do you believe that they would be threatened with excommunication if they had voted the other way?
I think it's entirely possible. You know, certainly, I mean, look at what they did with John Kerry. You had the guy who is now the Pope writing letters to Catholic bishops in the United States during the 2004 election saying that they should refuse to offer communion to John Kerry because he supported a woman's right to an abortion. So, you know, your question is one that, you know, we'll never know the answer to, but I think that we can infer some reality to. And one that, frankly, I think that we should be concerned about. I would like to see people on the court say explicitly, as John Kennedy did. He said, I'm not the Catholic candidate for president. I'm the Democratic candidate for president. And I think people on Supreme Court should say that they are not, you know, all nine of them, that they're not there to exercise their religion. 45 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Conservative Christians right-wing Republican, straight white American males. Soul-saving, flag-waving, brush-loving, land-paving, personal friends to the quails. Quite diligently, working so hard to keep the free brains of this democracy. From tree-hugging, peace-loving, pot-smoking, barefooting, folks singing, hippies lying. Tree-hugging, peace-loving, pot-smoking, corn-watching, lazy ass, hippies like me.
Yes, indeed, here we are. 9.5 minutes before the hour. By the way, the Death with Dignity Act here in Oregon passed originally. It was a ballot initiative. We could never get the legislators to have enough courage to do this. And so the people did it themselves, 51%. It was then, conservatives then put on a measure in 97 to repeal it. That was defeated by 60%. Then John Ashcroft filed a lawsuit against the state of Oregon. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal turned it down. He took it to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, in 2006, turned it down as well, turned down Ashcroft's appeal, and so we still have the law on the books here in Oregon. No thanks to Mr. Ashcroft, or our local cons. James in St. Agito, Maine, is that it?
Hello?
James? Hi, James. How do you pronounce your city?
St. Agatha.
St. Agatha. Okay. Hey, what's up?
How you doing, Don? Yeah, I was calling in reference to a discussion we were having just a little while ago about this assisted dying. And this
right. Person
was talking about the what the soul versus the body, you know, if you do something to the body, you'll do something to the soul. Here's my question, and I think it goes a long ways into explaining the differences between liberals and conservatives. How in the world can you have a discussion about an entity which I'm almost positive that nobody's ever been able to prove that you can assign material things to?
That's why I said, you know, okay, if you're acknowledging the existence of a soul, then why torture it? You know, and you know, are you assuming that if you go to heaven, you must have some consciousness, therefore it must be conscious? I mean, you know, without the point is that you either decide that there is or you decide that there isn't, but in either case, the argument would be the same. Why torture a conscious human being or why torture a soul? I mean, it just makes no sense. It's all about control, in my opinion. And you know, if you're doing it, you know, I think the crux of it was his argument that it's sin. And that takes us back to the fact that we're trying to put into law legislation that basically enforces religious codes. And that is antithetical, in my opinion, to what this country was founded on. Len in New York City. Hey, Len.
Hi. Well, that's what I was just going to say. And, you know, I actually, since I called, you know, you can tie this into George Packer's recent article about Iraq. And, you know, but people want in their lives is some feeling of control, that there's an order, that there's not continuous entropy. And I think a lot of these moral issues that people like to try to determine for other people is a sense, creating a sense of order. And at the same time, you look at what George Packer was talking about, you know, he interviewed all these people in Iraq, you know, who had a sense of order for so many years that was so hated. But they presumed because they were all followers, I mean, effectively, like most people are in this society, they assumed that when we came in, that we'd offer them a new order. We weren't going to just cause entropy.
Right.
And I think it's the same thing with the...
Yeah.
With the
I would take it even
morality.
A step... Yeah, I would take it, well said, Len. I would take it even a step beyond that, and I would say that what conservatives are all about, because the major difference between conservatives and liberals, going all the way back to the Enlightenment, is that conservatives believe humans are essentially evil, and if they're not restrained by church or government, they will act out their evil behaviors and you will have chaos. And liberals believe that humans are essentially good, and that the purpose of government is not to restrain people, although certainly we do need to restrain the occasional nutcase, but by and large, the purpose of government is to backstop people, is to help them achieve their highest potential. And if you believe that the purpose of government is to restrain people and the people are in need of restraint, then that's this very fearful place the most conservatives operate out of. So they're trying to constrain or restrain or control the largest number of people outside of themselves, whereas liberals would rather simply have control over their own lives. Thank you very much. If I want to end it, give me the option. If, you know, under appropriate circumstances, if I'm in pain and it's at the end of life. Deborah in Hazlitt, New Jersey. Hey, Deborah.
Hi. Oh, my God, I am so mad. I am steaming. I wrote it down so I wouldn't forget.
Okay.
Okay, so I got the Supreme Court has recently overturned partial abortion because, according to Roberts' Supreme Court, there is no reason for a second-term abortion. This leads me to believe that the Supreme Court, George Bush, and the conservative right wing are ready, willing, and able to treat American women a few pegs lower than their prized heifer.
Yeah, really. I mean, it's very often in the second term. Clay, if you can pop that down when I'm talking, it's very often during the second term that you discover the horrific birth defects that medically require and necessitate an abortion, Deborah.
Absolutely. You know, I'm just livid. I can't believe it. I'm just out of my mind.
No.
But
no.
I'm
right. Thank you very much, Deborah. I'm right there with you, as are many of us. June in Portland, Oregon. Hey, June.
Oh, hi, Tom. Always a great show. My own, there's always been a method available to anybody. My own sister-in-law, 92, had wearied of life. She'd already lost two of her three adult children. She simply stopped eating and drinking and died peacefully in her own bed. She was attended daily by a hospice volunteer. I got almost regular daily reports from her remaining child, daughter.
Yes.
And
in fact, the Oregonian did a large story about that, I remember, some months ago, and it was fascinating to see. But I think that a lot of people, A, don't realize that that's an option, B, don't realize how it works, or C, simply can't deal with, you know, hunger and thirst in the way that you would have to in order to do that. But June, good point. Well made. I still think that if, particularly in a society where we tend to turn to physicians, if our physicians can help us through life, if they can help us preserve life, if they can help us be sick or you know, recover from sickness, then when there is no recovery at all, they can help us avoid pain at the end. 57 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio, where smart people get their news.
Six minutes past the hour. From now on, from this point forward, 50% of all news reports must be positive. Thus saith Vladimir Putin. This is, on the one hand, spooky. On the other hand, it should give us cause for a small amount of soul searching. This is in yesterday's New York Times, Andrew Kramer writing. At their first meeting with journalists since taking over Russia's largest independent radio news network, the managers had startling news of their own. From now on, they said at least 50% of the news reports about Russia must be, quote, positive, end quote. In addition, opposition leaders could not be mentioned on the air. And the United States was to be portrayed as an enemy. When the journalists said, what's positive news? They were told, when we talk of death, violence, or poverty, for example, that is not positive. If the stock market is up, that is positive. The weather can also be positive. Now, the Kremlin, Vladimir Putin, controls the three major television networks, but there are independent television outlets, television stations, and secondary networks, and there are a number of independently owned newspapers. One of the news outlets, one of the television networks, one of the larger, but not one of the big three, one of the larger television networks is owned by Gazprom. They also own newspapers and magazines. Gazprom is a natural gas company
that is also owned by the state. So here you have a arguably semi-private corporation owning a bunch of media assets, sort of like General Electric owning NBC. Also this month, a bank loyal to President Vladimir Putin tightened its control of an independent television station that it owns, and Parliament passed a measure banning, quote, extremism, end quote, in politics, and prosecutors are now going after individuals who post comments critical of the Putin administration on web chat rooms. This information derived from an article in yesterday's New York Times by Andrew Kramer. Kramer writes, Parliament on Wednesday passed a law allowing for prison sentences of as long as 3 years for, quote, vandalism, end quote, motivated by politics or ideology. Once again, vandalism is interpreted broadly, human rights groups say, including acts of civil disobedience. In a test case, Moscow prosecutors are pursuing a criminal case against a political advocate accused of posting critical remarks about a member of parliament on a website. By the way, you saw where the Garry Kasparov, the former chess grandmaster, was taking on Putin and leading protests in Moscow and St. Petersburg over the weekend. They were ignored on the media channels in Moscow. Rossiya TV, for example, led its newscast last Saturday with Mr. Putin attending a martial arts competition with the Belgian actor Jean-Claude Van Damme as his guest. On the streets of the capital that day, 54 people were beaten badly enough by the police that they sought medical care, according to Human Rights Watch. It was not covered in the Russian media. NTV and Rossiya and Channel 1, which is Rossiya and Channel 1, they're owned by NTV, and they're owned, which is in turn owned by Gazprom. Last week, a St. Petersburg bank with ties to Mr. Putin increased its ownership stake in Ren TV, a channel that sometimes broadcasts critical reports, raising questions about that outlet's continued independence. The Russian news service is owned by other businesses loyal to the Kremlin, including Lukoil. This company, Russian Radio's shareholders, asked for the resignation of their leader, Mr. Baklanov. He was replaced by Alexander Shkolnik, who then said that 50% of the news must be positive, regardless of what cataclysm might befall Russia on any given day. Why? Well, the editor of the news service said this is being done to attract a larger, younger audience. Now, we look at this and we go, oh, my God, in Russia, there is no longer any press freedom. Real news is not being covered. 50% of the news has to be happy news. Presumably, happy news would be things like, who is the father of Anna Nicole Smith's baby? Did Britney Spears go into or get out of rehab? Are you starting to hear some faint echoes? Patricia Goldsmith at dissidentvoice.org wrote an article, Restore Fairness, Return Reality. She points out that the defeat of the Fairness Doctrine, this was back in 1987, and then the Telecommunications Act of 1996, the respective works of Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton, was followed in 2000 by the defeat of two corollary FCC guidelines, the political editorial rule. This used to be the law in the United States, FCC law, but It required stations that editorialized against a political candidate to notify that candidate within 24 hours and allow him or her to respond. That's out the window. Thus, Sinclair Broadcasting could swift boat John Kerry. John Kerry had no recourse. and the personal attack rule, which required a station to notify someone within a week of a personal attack made on the air and offer them time to respond. That's gone, too. Now, when Orrin Hatch went on NBC, Face the Nation, and lied to the American people and to Tim Russert about Carol Lamb, saying that she had worked on Bill Clinton's campaign when, in fact, she'd always been a good Republican, that she'd never been a prosecutor when, in fact, she'd been a prosecutor for 18 years, that she was some sort of law professor when, in fact, she'd never been a law professor. When Orrin Hatch went on NBC's Face the Nation, NBC owned by General Electric, when Orrin Hatch went on there and lied about Carol Lamb, do you think he would have done that if he knew in advance? And do you think, for that matter, that Tim Russert would have let him get away with it? If they both knew, as was the law in the United States up until 2000, that by doing so, NBC would then have to allow Carol Lamb or her representative to come on and say, excuse me, what he said was a lie. Here's the truth. I don't think Orrin Hatch would have told that lie if he knew that he could be called out on it. And I don't, and NBC's apology for it a week later was simply, for Russert simply to say, go look at our website if you want to see what really happened. Say, what? You can lie to 10, 20, 30 million people and then cover it up or correct it, in quotes, by saying, well, go check out our website. Which then leads us to the multinational monitor. And ultimately to Alberto Gonzalez. Where I'm going with all this is Alberto Gonzalez. But, follow the steps here. This is a couple of years ago, an interview with Jeff Cohen. Caveat, I know Jeff Cohen. Jeff, the founder of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, the former producer of The Donahue Show. He says, and I'm quoting Jeff Cohen here, historically, NBC staffers have been self-censoring since almost the day General Electric took over NBC. There was the famous incident in 1989 when a reporter at NBC in Chicago had done a solid story on defective bolts that were used by GE. They were supposed to be certified, and they weren't. It was believed those bolts had been used in airplanes, bridges, and nuclear power plants. The NBC reporter set the story off to the Today Show. Before it aired, they surgically removed all references to General Electric from the story. In 1990, the NBC-owned, GE-owned, NBC-owned Today Show did a segment on consumer boycotts. Todd Putnam, the editor of National Boycott News, showed up. They explicitly told him they didn't want him to mention the fact that there was an ongoing consumer boycott of General Electric products. He could talk about Hormel ham, he could talk about tuna fish because of the dolphins, but when he brought out a GE light bulb to put on the table of boycotted products, there's not room to put that light bulb on the table. It was never mentioned. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. Well, see, here's the problem. I don't think Gonzalez should go. Let me just lay that right out. And frankly, I think this all ties back into this whole issue of massive corporate, multinational corporate control. Here you have General Electric, a company that does more than half its business outside the United States, owning the major news media in the United States, in particular the cable media that controls much of the political dialogue in the United States, MSNBC, and NBC, the national network. And, you know, running like Soledad O'Brien doing NBC Nightly News puff piece on nuclear power. Well, GE's big in the nuclear power industry. You never find coverage of corporate welfare on NBC, and yet GE is a huge recipient of corporate welfare. They did three segments in a row on their evening news on a new machine that detects breast cancer without mentioning that General Electric made it. Tom Brokaw during the Gulf War saying the Patriot missile, it's the missile that put the Iraqi Scud in its place. Sorry, that was a hoax, but it was almost a complete failure, but the parts were made by General Electric. It was never acknowledged that many of the weapons used in the Iraq War were very profitable to General Electric. Over the years, they've sponsored many of the Sunday pundit shows like Meet the Press. They started, General Electric started the McLaughlin Group with a big grant after Ronald Reagan was used to arrange a meeting between John McLaughlin and Jack Welch, the CEO of GE. They also fund Marketplace, the public radio show. This is a profit-making company. They're not doing this because, you know, gee, let's be nice. I mean, prior to that, John McLaughlin was a right-wing commentator. GE lobbyists helped write a tax reform bill for Reagan in 1981, reducing GE's tax burden to below zero. Was it reported on NBC? No. I mean, this is pretty straightforward stuff. So now we get to Alberto Gonzalez. Why is the media not pointing out the fact that there is a concerted effort across the United States to do two things at the federal level? One is to consolidate all of the power in the executive branch, because that's the only branch that the Republicans control right now, and to some extent in the judiciary. But by and large, the executive branch. Why? And number two, why is that power then being used to disenfranchise, to systematically disenfranchise minority voters from coast to coast by prosecutions of so-called voter fraud? Yes, there have been 24 of these people found now in the last 5 years that the Bushies have been looking for them. And they've had all their federal prosecutors having this as a top priority. And those who wouldn't make it a top priority got fired. And those who did make it a top priority, nope, none of them are looking at election fraud. Election fraud, things like 100,000 people their votes not being counted in Ohio in 2004, or 80,000 African Americans not even being allowed to vote in 2000. None of them are looking at election fraud, because that is being done by Republicans and Republican-connected corporations. Instead, they're looking at individual voters who, by accident in many cases, registered twice. They registered when they got their driver's license, sometimes without even realizing it, and then they signed their voter registration card. There's a woman in Minneapolis who's been in prison for a year for this. One of the major accomplishments of Bush's prosecutors. You have that. I mean, that's what's going on with Gonzogate. That's the bottom line, is that there is a massive systematic effort using the federal prosecutors from coast to coast to disenfranchise voters. We know that in the last election, between 4 and 5 million people either were not allowed to vote, who should have been allowed to vote, or who voted on placebo ballots, these so-called provisional ballots, and their count, and fewer than 1% are ever counted, because they showed up, they thought they were registered to vote, but hey, sorry, you were voting while black, you were voting while Democratic, we moved your precinct, we didn't have enough machines, sorry, here, fill out this placebo ballot. 5 million votes. That's what's at the core of Gonzogate. And it's not being discussed in the mainstream media, because the mainstream media is part of the same machine that is the Bush administration. Wealth and power, massive multinational corporate wealth and power looking out for itself. And at the same time, the subtext of all of Alberto Gonzalez's testimony before Congress was, I'm here to patronize you senators, and I'll make a fool of myself for George, but you guys don't have the power to do anything. It's up to Bush whether or not he wants to fire me, because he's the unitary executive. I don't have to answer to you. That was the subtext of his message. And the senators were eating it up. I mean, they were going along with it. They were not challenging this. It's frankly astounding, this whole theory of the unitary power of government and the election fraud that was committed by Bush. I'll give you the details right after this, 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
All I know.
34 minutes past the hour. Okay, so here's the bottom line. They say there's no underlying crime. There's nothing.
There's no droids here. Just keep on going.
There is a series of underlying crimes. From the dismissal of Mr. Cummings, the prosecutor, and his replacement by Carl Rove's aide, Tim Griffin, we find out that Cummings was actually looking into Mark Hearn, a high-level GOP operative. A criminal investigation. Doesn't seem to be going on anymore. A major at the top of the GOP, you had Carol Lamb prosecuting Republicans. She's out. And then with Iglesias, you've got strong evidence. I mean, this is incredible. Here you had David Iglesias, the New Mexico U.S. attorney, being pressured by Heather Wilson and by Pete Domenici to try and prosecute some Democrats just before the election, so as the prosecutor did up in Wisconsin. As I said, we need to be looking at the prosecutors who stayed in office as well as the ones who left. This is an organized criminal conspiracy within the Republican Party, headed up by Karl Rove and George W. Bush. Mark my words. The Albuquerque Journal lays this whole thing out. They said that when Domenici called Gonzalez and said, fire this guy, Iglesias, he won't prosecute Democrats, Gonzalez said, I can only do it if the president gives the okay. The president gives the okay, they fire him. Who's the decider? Bush. So when I said earlier, I don't want to see Alberto Gonzalez resign, the reason I don't want to see him resign, and here you've got all these Republicans essentially, you know, calling for his resignation.
Mr. Attorney General, it's my considered opinion that the exact same standards should be applied to you and how this was handled. It was handled incompetently. The communication was atrocious. It was inconsistent. It's generous to say that there were misstatements.
Now, that's Tom Coburn, the Republican from Oklahoma. Okay, so let's make it look like Gonzalez is incompetent. Let's make it look like he's a screw-up. Let's make it look like he doesn't know how to communicate. All those are great reasons to fire him so that we can stop looking into what's going on. I want Gonzalez impeached and Bush along with him. Impeachment means that you file charges against them in the House of Representatives. You launch investigations into what they were doing that might rise to the level of high crimes and misdemeanors. You demonstrate whether or not there is any truth to those by calling witnesses under oath to give testimony. And if you find that Gonzalez has been using the Justice Department, has been using federal prosecutors as political instruments for the Republican Party and for the Bush administration, then you don't just fire him or allow him to resign. You impeach him and hand him over to the Senate for conviction. And after impeachment and conviction in the Senate, he may be liable for prosecution under federal statutes. But the Republicans now, you've got Republicans out there saying, oh, well, you know, Gonzalez, he's just screwed up. He's just incompetent. We should let him go. And you've got a corporate media going along with this because they don't see there's nothing in it to them to have the major power structures in this country, which are supportive of multinationals owning our media and supportive of multinationals owning our trade policy and supportive of multinational corporations owning our health policy and our health care programs and squeezing every last dime out of us. Oh, the economy is great if you're a millionaire or a billionaire. You have all of them saying, well, there's no underlying crime here. Well, we're not going to do any serious investigative report. We're not going to look into this. I mean, here, the Albuquerque Journal is the only publication interested in this? I don't get it. I don't get it. Well, actually, I do. And that's it. I mean, I lay it out for you. That what is going on here are high crimes and misdemeanors being committed in the Justice Department under the specific direction of George W. Bush. This was made clear when Gonzalez told Domenici that he could not fire Iglesias without Bush signing off on it, and then it happened. And nobody has asked the question of Gonzalez, when did Bush sign off on the firing of Iglesias? And nobody's asking Domenici that question. Charlie in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Charlie.
Hey, Tom. Just a correction from last week. Jared Diamond's Gun, Germs, and Steel. He clearly says that the kleptocracy disarms the populace. He's talking about high-tech weaponry, which is produced only in industrial plants and monopolized by an elite rather than the old arms where people would make spears and clubs at home. So that was the point. Also, Meet the Press is the Tim Russert program that's on GE and NBC, not Face the Nation.
Oh, thank you for correcting
me. But the point that you're making is very important. I mean, this is the top law enforcement officer in the country. Bush today, which is widely reported, NPR, all the commercial stations, said that Gonzalez did a great job there in the hearing, and he only has more confidence in him. I mean, this is like battered citizen syndrome. You get a whiplash.
Right.
You hear the president telling outright lies. It's almost like Hitler and Goebbels, you know.
Well, and the subtext to it all is if Gonzalez is going to go, Bush is going to make the decision because he's the unitary executive. He's the one who gets to make all decisions, period. Thank you very much. We don't need any oversight from Congress. We will patronize them. We will pat them on the head. We will go show up. We'll even make a fool of ourselves in front of them if that's the cost of stopping this investigation right here in its tracks. And as they did, by the way, I would submit to you with Iran-Contra, where Congress achieved a compromise where they said that they would not look into anything that happened with regard to Iran-Contra before 1983. In other words, they weren't going to look into the theft of the election in 1980, which is when Iran-Contra actually started.
Sure.
You know, when Reagan was selling weapons for hostages to the Iranians, there were no hostages. The hostages that was a trade-off for was 1980.
Yeah.
And I just see the entire same thing being played out all over again. Charlie, good point. Thank you very much. Patricia in Oregon. Hey, Patricia. You are
Hello?
On the air, Patricia. You are on the air, Patricia.
Hello?
Hello? Hello? Patricia, yeah. I'm going to put you on hold. I'm sorry. You need to turn off your radio and listen to your phone. Lynn in Boston, Mass. Hey, Lynn, what's up?
Hi. I just wanted to ask if you have come across the scandal in Texas that feeds into this attorney's firing thing. Specifically, there was an individual named in one of the emails, I think his name, well, actually, this is sort of a side issue, Mickey Barnett, who is Bush's appointee to a U.S. Postal Commission or something. Evidently, he was very, very active in the New Mexico voter fraud picture and was down in Florida working on that. But more to the point, in Texas, there is a huge scandal involving pedophilia in the juvenile facilities there.
Oh, yeah.
that implicated Johnny Sutton, not so much as directly involved, but just turning a blind eye. He and Alberto Gonzalez turned a blind eye to the federal prosecution.
Right. They're doing their very best to bury the whole story right now.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. And what's interesting to me is that, you know, when Iglesias went up to Chicago and sat there with Patrick Fitzgerald, what was the biggest irony, visual irony ever, but he's claiming that what they want to do, they want to kick off this Justice Department action against pedophilia on the Internet. And I would mark everyone to be very cautious about their efforts to do the anti-gambling, the anti-pedophilia on the Internet, because it will be their inroads.
These are stalking horses. These are stalking horses. These are all ways of cracking down on the Internet the
exact same way that
Russia is doing right now. How dare you post that to that website? I mean, it always starts out that way. You look back at the pornography laws, you look at the drug laws, it always starts out with some reasonable little nose under the camel's tent, and then pretty soon, bang, they're down on everybody like a ton of bricks. Good point, Lynn. Thank you very much for making it. Eric in Manhattan. Hey, Eric.
Hey, Tom. On Friday, the New York Times ran a news analysis by Cheryl Gay Stolberg on the Gonzalez hearing, and she made the rather absurd statement that, the Congress has no power to remove the Attorney General.
Nonsense.
Nonsense.
They have the power of impeachment. It's right there in the Constitution. He's a federal officer. All federal officers are subject to impeachment.
Right. And I wrote them a letter to that effect, and to this point, there's been no correction. So.
Yeah. Well, surprise, surprise.
Surprise.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Eric, John in Los Angeles. Hey, John, about a half a minute before we've got to take a break.
Yes. I would like everybody to learn more about Gonzalez's predecessor through criminal proceedings, not in looking for impeachment, but to charge John Ashcroft with what crimes he did while he was serving in that role, as well as what he did to Carnahan when he was running for Senate.
Yeah, exactly. But see, John, this highlights my point about why I don't want him to resign, because we have this political culture that says that once somebody's out of office, you don't go after them. And I think it's something that all the politicians do because they know that someday they'll be out of office and they don't want anybody going after them. And so you have to go after them while they're in office. So keep Gonzo in place and go after him. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
9.5 minutes before the hour. Here's acceptable speech by Republicans.
The Attorney General.
This, by the way, Arlen Specter on Fox News Sunday.
The Attorney General's testimony was very, very damaging to his own credibility. It has been damaging to the administration because without answers as to what really happened, there's a lot of speculation. And the charges are being made that the Department of Justice was the political arm of the White House. Now, there's no proof of that, but there's no proof of anything else either.
So see, you can get as close, you can almost dance up to the possibility that they might have been the political arm of, and therefore that would be a crime. Well, you can't do the therefore, and then you've always got to say, but there's no proof. There's no proof. There's 5 million missing emails, but there's no proof. You know, if the White House tapes had not been produced 33 years ago this month, or it had not been subpoenaed 33 years ago this month and produced 33 years ago, July. In August, all the Republicans on the House Judiciary Committee would not have voted to impeach Nixon, thus leading him to resign. Hutch in Framelfador
and New Jersey.
New Jersey.
But you know, you're gonna have to do the cost of an engineer.
Say what, Hutch?
Hey.
Hutch is having a phone call. Here, Scott in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Scott.
Yeah, you know, I tried to get on your segment on Friday with Senator Bernie Sanders, and I wasn't able to do that. But you know what I would have said to him as far as what this situation ties into? And he was mentioning the fact that, you know, they're doing all this these investigations as a result of the change of the Congress. Well, yes, that is great, but, you know, where are you going to go forth once you find out the result of these investigations, just like with this thing that's going on now?
Well, that's my point. Where you go is impeachment. You indict these guys in the House of Representatives for specific crimes that you identify in these hearings. And that's, I call this the Bernie problem. I mean, you've got, you know, Bernie Sanders, a good guy. He's not even a Democrat. And he's saying, you know, we can't do impeachment until at least there's clear evidence of crimes. Those, they need to be laid out, and they need to be laid out in a way that the majority of Americans realize they're there. And one of the problems we have right now is the media is not even talking about these issues. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with TalkRadioNews.com. Hey, Ellen, welcome to the program.
In fact, actually, on Wednesday, there's going to be an impeachment rally, which Dennis Kucinich, I believe, as I understand it, you might want to get him on the air, is going to file for some articles of impeachment.
Yes, we contacted his office last week, and in fact, we had him set up to be on a couple of times, and he no-showed. And in any case, we're continuing to work on it.
Okay, Mr. Gonzalez has gotten the support of the president today. The president took a Q&A after his speech on the supplemental, and he said that Gonzalez answered every question he could have possibly, and he answered in a way that increased my ability to understand how he would do the job. In other words, he has the support of the president.
Yeah,
and then he also
job.
Said that attorneys serve at the pleasure, the U.S. attorneys serve at the pleasure of the president. Of course, they're a day late and a dollar short with that argument.
Yeah. See, I think that this is all an attempt to cover up a criminal conspiracy coming out of the White House. It was, you know, Pete Domenici was told by Alberto Gonzalez that the only way Iglesias could be fired was if George Bush approved it. And then shortly thereafter, Iglesias got fired. This goes all the way to the White House.
Just like the tapes 33 years ago, I actually think this is going to all come out in the wash. It may take 6 months, but I actually think it is going to happen. And in
From
fact,
your lips
on
to God's
issue,
ears.
On that issue today, Henry Waxman sent a letter to private citizen Andrew Card, who was White House Chief of Staff, and said that there has been a systematic neglect of basic rules. He asked that he cooperate in the inquiry and appear voluntarily to his committee.
Whoa, when?
He didn't give a date, but the letter went out today, as I understand it.
Boy, Henry Waxman has been issuing a lot of letters and a lot of subpoenas. He's really digging into this stuff. He better stay away from small airplanes.
I think he flies the big ones out to California. A few other interesting things today, actually. There was and has been an appropriations conference chaired by David Obey, and this has to do with the supplemental bill. The Radio TV Gallery is actually quite furious about this because he denied TV coverage of this and only allowed pen and pencil to the supplemental markup. And Radio TV, on a sort of very bipartisan journalistic basis, put in a request saying that that was unfair and that there had been greater transparency promised by Nancy Pelosi on these kinds of things, and this was not happening.
Yeah, this is David Obey, the Democrat from Wisconsin?
Yes.
Huh. Interesting. Why?
Unsure why. He didn't really give a reason, just said that there would be no television coverage. And that really meant no audio coverage, so no radio coverage either.
Yeah.
Actually, there's a couple other things interesting. There was a report this weekend about the fact that Gore's campaign team was meeting in secret, but even before that came out, I heard from a very knowledgeable source in the Democratic Party that Gore's people, Mr. Knight, had not said he did not rule it out completely, but before he had ruled it out completely, I think that we may see some activity on the Gore front around this campaign.
The possibility of Al Gore running for president of the United States.
I am not going to rule it out either, and I know some big people have really withheld their endorsement of any candidate pending Mr. Gore.
That's very interesting. I mean, I spoke with him personally and I about this issue, and I was convinced that he was quite sincere in saying he had no interest. Of course, that was about 5 months ago. So
right, I think things change.
There's
no clear front runner.
Indeed. 57 minutes past the hour. Thanks, Ellen.
The Tom Hartman Program. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio. Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Well, it's always a great, great thing. Welcome back, by the way. It's always a great, great thing to be able to read writing that is written in a way that is fun to read, that is interesting, that is informative, that it just flows. And one of the best writers out there is Laura Flanders, also a radio host here on Air America Radio. Laura Flanders, welcome to the program.
Oh, Tom, it's great to be with you. What fun.
Indeed. You have a marvelous new program, new book out. It's right here in my hand. Blue Grit, True Democrats Take Back Politics from the Politicians. And I loved this thing. In particular, my favorite part of it was the Montana Miracle. do you mind telling us that story?
Oh, I don't at all. You know, we in the media, you and I know, often critique our fellows in the media. And one of the criticisms we make is that we often cover elections as if they were horse races. And the problem with that is it makes it look as if the only players that matter are the damn horses. This whole book, Blue Grit, is trying to refocus attention on the stands, the people in the bleachers. And that's what that Montana chapter is about. I mean, read most of the coverage and you would have thought that this miracle just happened when Brian Schweitzer was elected governor, first Democrat in 16 years, or when John Tester...
And arguably one of the most progressive governors in the United States.
Great guy, no question. John Tester, the same way when he knocked out Conrad Burns from the Senate. But the coverage would lead you to believe that if we could just get Democrats to wear cowboy boots and bolo ties like Schweitzer, that would be all they need to do to win. This is about trying to say there was a little bit more to it, as Schweitzer and Tester will be the first to say, and let's learn from what really happened, which was actually the grassroots groups, environmentalists, women organizations, Native Americans, and a very smart state Democratic Party pulled off a victory that was 10 years in the making. That's the story we need to hear about if we want to repeat it anywhere else.
Yeah, and the echo of your, or the theme that recurs throughout your book is one that in the last chapter of my last book, I quoted one of our listeners, Roy in Placidas, New Mexico, who made the comment, and I think he was quoting somebody, he made the comment that that what politicians are waiting for basically is the parade. And when a big enough parade is going down the street and everybody's all passionate and, wow, you know, you can't deny that's a huge parade, then the politician will run out in front of it and hoist a flag and say, oh, this is my parade.
Exactly.
And we need to be the parade.
That's true, and that's exactly what's happening in Congress today on the war, frankly. But, you know,
yeah.
I mean, that's okay. That's all right. It's just, you know, our coverage of politics, it's extraordinary. We understand on the right-hand side of the spectrum that power builds from the bottom up, and you have all that focus on how do the right do it and the role of the churches and the role of the NRA and the libertarian groups, but we very rarely look at the similar picture on the left-hand side where it happens exactly the same way. The people lead, the leaders follow. I bet you've said that before.
Indeed. And your analysis of the contemporary Democratic Party.
Well, you know, I mean, I think the Democratic Party is at a turning point, and I'm afraid we've said that before, too. But this does seem like a crunch moment to me, where you have what I call the penthouse party, the people who built up this tremendous, warehouse of major donors, and this left us with this beautiful, sparkling DNC headquarters in Washington. I'm thinking of the Clintons and Terry McAuliffe.
Mm-hmm.
But they decided to do that rather than build up state strength. And I say that's the problem with the penthouse party. It's all top floor suites, no power in the streets. That's what Howard Dean discovered in 2005 when he took over the DNC. Where we find ourselves now is a lot of people in the States got it. There's been nobody driving the bus, and they've figured out how to take control of the wheel. That's happening in Montana. It's happening even in places like Utah, Nevada. A lot of the places I went for this book, grassrootsers with blue grit are getting in there, learning how to draw up precinct maps, get election rolls, and run for office in primaries and in general elections. Where we're at now, I think, is the party, there's no debating, came to office in November thanks to blue gritters. Are they going to let them be part of the team that steers the ship, or are they going to be asked to be just stay in their nice distant spots as ground troops? I think being a ground troop, the thrill of that wears off fast.
Yeah, indeed. You wrote about an entire book called Bushwomen. In fact, we talked about it on this program a year or so ago. And Tales of a Cynical Species, as I recall the subtitle. What's your take on Hillary Clinton?
Well, you know, as a woman, I have to say, to see a woman so hungry for power is sort of exciting. But as a human, I find it terrifying. I don't know how you feel, but I am very concerned that she is in a tradition of executive power, uberalis. That this is a woman who, I believe, voted for the Iraq War resolution less because she was convinced the weapons of mass destruction than that she believed the president should have those executive powers. And maybe she's staying relatively mum about the president signing statements and abuse of executive powers today because she's kind of keen on having those powers in a White House that she might be part of. So, I don't know, she makes me extremely nervous. On the other hand, having done that book about the Bush women, I am keenly aware of what a free ride they gave the women of the right and how much sexism has been piled on her already this early in this fight. So I guess I'm not mixed politically, but personally I do think some of the coverage has been really objectionable.
Oh, absolutely. My take on it is twofold. One, I am concerned that she is a politician in the mold of Maggie Thatcher.
You bet.
To some extent, to a large extent, and that concerns me. On the other hand, Franklin Roosevelt in 1932 ran on a very, I'm reluctant to use the word conservative because it wasn't by today's definitions, but a very Hillary Clinton-like platform of, you know, small incremental change, no big sweeping thing. You know, the New Deal was an afterthought that he tossed into a speech he was writing just before the election.
Well, but he had Eleanor at his side. And
well,
Eleanor in his ear, and Eleanor's elbow, I suspect, in his ribs.
Right. And he had, I mean, he was living in the era of the bonus army and everything else. I mean, he had the people. I mean, the parade was getting louder and louder and louder. It had only been, you know, 20 years since the end of the progressive era, since the end of, you know, the whole thing that his distant cousin Teddy had been involved in. And frankly, I think once he got into the presidency, he felt that wind and said, okay, we'll put up the sails and we'll go with it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, hope springs eternal in my mind. I think it's more important, frankly, whether our president is Hillary or John Edwards, who I personally think is a great guy, or Barack Obama, who I think may be a great guy. I don't frankly know enough about him. Or whatever, you know, whomever it may be. I think it's the most important thing is not who's the president or who's the head of the party or who's the head of the ticket. I think the most important thing is how many of us are involved in party politics. And this is where I encourage people who are Green Party members, people who are Progressive Party members, right across the spectrum, to also get involved in the Democratic Party. Let's infiltrate that sucker and take it over. It's a huge multi-million dollar machine, and it's just sitting there waiting for us to grab hold of it.
Well, I'm absolutely with you, Tom, and I think that you and I maintain a very similar kind of drumbeat on Air America, that this is a moment where people are getting involved and they are shifting the debate, and whether the Democratic Party leadership gets on board with that or not, it's happening. It's happening on the minimum wage. It's happening on alternative sentencing. It's happening on Iraq. It's happening on health care. You name it. The issues are innumerable. Biofuels is another one. You know, I traveled all over the country and found some of the most surprising people backing very progressive policy. Family farmers old school ranches in eastern Montana who are wild for biofuel because they can run their equipment on it and they can grow another cash crop that helps the family.
Right.
You know,
and they don't need money to send money to Osama bin Laden's family.
And I just spent the entire time thinking, I wish the Democratic leadership had an ear to these people because there are agendas here you could embrace and run with to victory. And it's happening from the bottom up. It always works that way.
We need to speed it up. Laura, 30 seconds to go here. And I'm just curious, how do we move, in your mind, how do we move forward an impeachment agenda? Or do you think that that's unwise?
Hey, we're moving forward an impeachment agenda. Go Vermont.
Well, talk to any of your federal politicians, though. They are, it's radioactive.
Well, I don't think it'll be radioactive come the fall. I think we've got a huge amount of movement on this issue, as we've had on the war, with very little national leadership. It's coming from the bottom up. It's making a difference. What we've got to get is a party that gets it, that their base matters. And what happens at the margin matters. We pay attention to it on the right. We tend to ignore it on the left. That's what's shifting, and it's got to change.
Well said. Laura Flanders, her new book, Blue Grit, True Democrats, Take Back Politics, from the politicians. Laura, thanks so much for being
here. Thanks, Tom.
Great talking with you. Laura, of course, also hosts Radio Nation, airing Saturdays 7 to 10 on Air America, and the author of numerous other great books as well. 16 minutes past the hour. Your call's up next.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
George Bush in 2000 came to Washington.
These are historic times.
The GOP took over, came on way too strong.
Ideology of hate.
Gave away the store with a made-up war out in Iraq.
I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq.
They and their Halliburton friends hope it'll never stop.
We're beginning to see some signs of progress.
6 years in, now the Democrats win, they will still fund the war. But they say one more year ought to do it. One more year and then we're through it.
There's a new Congress in town.
But George Bush says no, oh, with a veto.
I will veto it if it comes to my desk.
Oh, 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 oh. They give the money, but he runs the show. To him, you don't say no. You get no say-so veto.
My veto would be sustained.
Oh, oh, oh. One more surge ought to get them. Escalation win them. One more fall.
We're going to win.
George Bush runs to refuse those funds and he adds a note.
Democrats have sent their message.
Saying toe the line of blow. And that was all he wrote.
Now it's time to send him money.
He'd be running around in circles, then reaching for his veto and going for broke.
Bring him on. Bring them on.
Saying one more hit ought to do it. Don't tell me how to screw it.
I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
No one tells me no. Oh, you get a veto.
Oh, indeed, you get a veto. 22 minutes past the hour. And time now for our liberal shadow alert. Indeed, dear liberal shadow here, laying out the evil that lurks in the hearts of conservatives.
Who has created a situation, ethics, essentially zone of not being willing to talk about any of these things? Let me carry another example. Where I strongly supported Imus being dismissed. But I also think the very thing he was dismissed for, which is the use of language, which is stunningly degrading of women. The fact, for example, that one of the Halloween costumes this last year was being able to be either a prostitute or a pimp at 10, 11, 12 years of age buying a costume. And we don't have any discussion about what's happened to our culture because while we're restricting political free speech under McCain-Feingold, we say it's impossible to restrict vulgar and vicious and anti-human speech. And I would argue that that's a major component of what's happened to our culture over the last 40 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mr. Gingrich. And my apologies, I thought that was a different clip. I thought it was Gingrich saying, I want to say to the elite of this country, the elite news media, the elite liberal academic elite, the liberal political elite, I accuse you in Littleton. And then he, when he was asked by George Stephanopoulos, would you apply those same words to the Virginia Tech tragedy? Yes, he said. In 1994, after Susan Smith confessed to drowning her two children in South Carolina, Gingrich quickly blamed liberals, saying the only way to avoid similar future incidents was to vote Republican. Yes, voting Republican will solve the problem of mental illness in the United States. After Congressman Mark Foley was forced to resign, Gingrich claimed that conservatives didn't want to stop him because they would have been accused of gay bashing by liberals. Right. As if being gay had anything to do with pedophilia. At the Conservative Political Action Conference earlier this year, Gingrich blamed the residents of New Orleans' Ninth Ward for a failure of citizenship. He said that by being so uneducated and so unprepared, they literally couldn't get out of the way of a hurricane. No, they were actually told by FEMA, the mayor and governor of the state were told by FEMA not to use their buses, not to get out of the way of the hurricane, because FEMA was sending hundreds of buses. Give me a break, Newt. Matt in Oakland, California. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Not too much. I'm a big fan of the show. Thanks very much for having me on. Just wanted to mention, I have a little feedback here.
Okay.
Huey Long was
turn
one
your
of
radio
the
down.
Factors that I think pushed FDR in the direction of the progressive movement in addition to the kind of the Vox Populi. I just saw a documentary about him produced by PBS, which was excellent.
I agree. But see, Huey Long was... I mean, the Huey Long's claim to fame was that he was the voice of the people. The whole point is that you don't necessarily, you know, FDR as president is not necessarily pushed by people like you and me. He's pushed by the elected representatives who are pushed by people like you and me. And Huey right. Long was a populist. Huey Long was representing a hell of a lot of people, and FDR knew it, and so he had to pay attention to what was going on.
Right. Also, so, just so real quickly, that used to listen to Laura Flanders on my local NPR affiliate, and she's great.
Yeah, she is. She really and truly is. Thanks a lot, Matt. Pat in Granite Falls, Washington. Hey, Pat.
Hi, Tom. I'm thrilled. You are my lifesaver on the sea of misinformation. What I need to know, I've been reading most wonderful book, The U.S. Constitution, Blueprint for Democracy, and in 1787 they laid out very laboriously worked on the Justice Department, the Executive Department.
Pat, this is taking a little longer than I thought it would. I'm going to put you on hold, and we'll come back with your question right after the break. 27 minutes past the hour. We're also going to have Bob McChesney on after the break, freepress.net, and the author of Tragedy and Farce. Stick around.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Like to know, we really would. 34 minutes past the hour. By the way, let me call out a congratulations to Senators Byron Dorgan and Ron Wyden. Byron Dorgan and Ron Wyden writing a letter to Chief of Staff Josh Bolton of the White House, signed by 25 senators, saying the executive branch is not an extension of the Republican National Committee nor of any political party. Those who treat it as such must be held accountable. This getting back to my point that I think that what's going on behind Gonzo-gate is a massive conspiracy, and I use that word in its legal and criminal context, a massive conspiracy to rig elections in the United States and try to create single-party rule in the United States the way it was in the Soviet Union, also known as Karl Rove so famously and lovingly refers to it, a permanent Republican majority. One of the people who's done one of the finest jobs of exposing all the efforts toward this end, Bob McChesney, freepress.net, his website, or a writer for. He's the co-founder of freepress.net. He's also the author of a book, Tragedy and Farce, and right now also working on an assault. Here we have, from the founding of this country, literally from the George Washington administration to today, small newspapers and magazines have been subsidized by we the people because we felt that the press was such a vital and important part of democracy that it's the only industry written into the Constitution, the press in the First Amendment. And now they want to jack up postal rates on these small publications so that only the big, huge mega corporations will be able to afford our postal services. Bob McChesney, welcome to the program.
My pleasure, Tom. I'm honored to be here.
I'm honored to have you, Bob. You're doing just absolutely fabulous work from Free Press, .net right across the board. Tell us about this. Your website, stoppostalratehikes.com.
Yeah, it's a clunker, but it's worth going to stoppostalratehikes.com, or you can go to the freepress.net website and click through, which might be a little easier to remember. This issue just hit us in the last couple of weeks because postal rates are done so secretively compared to other communication policy that I almost feel like I should apologize to Michael Powell and the people at the FCC and Rupert Murdoch. And I've been chewing them out for years for how corrupt that whole process is. But compared to postal rates, that's like a Vermont town meeting. I mean, these postal rates were done. The body that's in charge of doing postal rates, called the Postal Regulatory Commission, actually got a recommendation for new postal rates from the Postal Service itself, the Post Office, which would have been pretty much an across-the-board equal increase for every magazine in the country. Instead, what they did...
In other words, just keeping up with inflation kind of thing.
More or less, actually a little more, and it was almost 12%. And all the publishers we talked to said we didn't like it, but we understood, they were under pressure to raise money. And then what happened was this Postal Regulatory Commission on its own took a proposal from Time Warner, the largest magazine publisher in the country, and basically adopted it. They said so in there when they issued it. They said, we took their plan. And their plan was very complicated. Even the Postal Service said they couldn't really quite understand it. But when people finally crunched the numbers on it, magazines found that instead of getting an 11 or 12% increase, the smaller publications were getting 15, 20, 25, even 30% increases immediately in July, and the big guys, when they crunch those numbers, are getting 7, 8, 9, 10% increases. So it was a shift of the burden of paying for the postage from the big guys to the little guys, raising the exact same amount of money.
Yeah, it's identical to the Bush tax cuts. Let's cut taxes on the millionaires and billionaires and raise taxes on the average person.
What's great about this, though, what's different about it is that in this case, it's not just a right versus left, because we have the entire spectrum of political views screwed by this. Our coalition on this campaign includes some people I'm not in bed with usually. National Review, American Conservative, American Spectator, and if you're sitting downtown, the Weekly Standard. Because they're all getting nailed by this.
Everybody pays postage.
That's right, and these are publications that for the most part are in it because they really believe in freedom of the press, they believe in political dialogue, they want to communicate, they think if their ideas get out, they'll win. They really believe in the value of their work, and so do people on the left and progressives. And the whole idea of postal rates in this country from 1792 when James Madison drew up the plans was we wanted to make it as easy as possible for people to publish and distribute newspapers and magazines, that we all win by that, not just the publishers, but a free society.
It was Madison. I was under the impression it was Washington. So I was
Madison was the architect, but Jefferson, as president, said he recommended that we have no postage whatsoever for any periodicals to encourage the distribution of magazines and newspapers.
Yeah, and they were subsidizing the cost of newsprint, of the creation of newsprint.
Now, the founders were strong believers that there was a public interest and obligation to make sure we had a viable free press, that everyone could read and everyone had access to media.
Now, don't the conservative publications who by and large believe in a laissez-faire world, in unregulated capitalism, aren't they in a little bit of a bind here? On the one hand, they believe the big corporations should be able to lobby as aggressively as they want and buy as many votes as they want, because after all, money is speech, and the people with the most money have the loudest speech, but they're entitled to, because as John Calvin pointed out, you got a lot of money, that means God has blessed you. Time Warner is the biggest fish in the pond. Excuse me. And they're using all their money to lobby Congress to change the postal regulations so that the smaller guys get screwed and Time Warner makes out like bandits. Isn't that consistent with the philosophical worldview of many of these conservative publications?
Well, it's consistent with sort of the Rovian worldview that might makes right and corruption is king. But no, the conservatives, to their credit, understand the post office is a government monopoly. And if you don't work through the post office, you go out of business. So it's not a competitive market where if they don't like the rates they're getting at the post office, there are five or six other vendors they can negotiate with. The post office is the only game in town. So they understand that the post office has to set rates that encourage competitive markets, not discourage them.
Right, but they also are all in favor of Monsanto lobbying the Bush administration to essentially legalize genetically modified foods by regulating them, by creating regulations. Actually, it was the Reagan administration.
I'm just glad Tom, they're in bed with me on this one. I mean,
let's not pick on them. Okay, all right. Okay, so, in fact, that is a tangent. You're right. We're talking with Bob McChesney, by the way. He's the co-founder of freepress.net, a great website, great news site, and stoppostalratehikes.com. Bob, is the postal regulator, whatever that service is that regulates postal rates?
It's a crony-run service with half political appointments who probably couldn't pass an entry-level course on freedom of the press.
They were put in there by the Bush administration?
Yeah, it's just political hacks. You know, the sort of people get appointed ambassador to Liechtenstein.
Right. The big fundraisers, or the medium-sized fundraisers for the Republican Party.
Precisely.
So when do they make the decision? How do we pressure them? How can we change this?
Yeah, this is the good news. They've made the decision. It goes into effect July 15th. But fortunately, Representative Danny Davis, who runs the relevant subcommittee in the U.S. House, has agreed to hold public hearings on this. Already they've heard people outraged by it. A lot of publishers are figuring out what the numbers are. And we're talking about a lot of publishers who think they might have to go out of business, this rate hike is so high. What listeners need to do to this show is they've got to go to freepress.net and click through, or to stoppostalratehikes.com. Sign the letter we're sending to both Congress and to the Postal Regulatory Commission. What we've been told by Danny Davis, what we've been told by members of Congress, is we're going against a very powerful lobby here that has spent tens of millions of dollars to get this lucrative, cushy deal. And if we're going to beat them, the only way we're going to do it is following Saul Alinsky model, organized people beating organized money. We need to get hundreds of thousands of people signing this letter saying we want hearings, we want to get to the bottom of this, we want the full implications studied, and we don't want to see a policy put in place which could literally drive a lot of the small media of this country out of business.
Right, and they can also call their member of Congress at 202-225-3121, 202-225-3121. If you're not sure who your Congress member of the House of Representatives is, simply give me your zip code. They'll direct you the right person. If you're not sure who your two senators are, tell them what state you live in, and they will tell you who they are, and you can connect yourself with their office. Each one of us has three elected officials, except those in Washington, D.C. We all have three elected officials in Washington, D.C., and you can call 202-225-3121 and simply say, stop this postal rate hike that's going to whack these small publishers. I mean, that's a simple enough way of saying it that they'll get it, right?
You know, and it's so true also. It's simply indefensible. I mean, the more I study this, the more laughable the whole process is. I've never seen a situation where a government authority will just blatantly announce that it's taken the policy proposal of the largest commercial interest and adopted it pretty much willy-nilly without investigating what the implications would be for the other players in the industry.
Well, it's what the mine safety, I forget what the acronym is, but the Mine Safety Administration did.
You know, they didn't even hire a PR firm to gloss it up with all sorts of BS to make us think they're doing it in the public interest. This is just blatant corruption.
Yeah, incredible. Corruption in the post office, or not in the post office, in the federal agency that regulates the post office that is stocked by cronies political appointees of the Bush administration. Why
in fact,
should we
the Postal Service has been great on this. Their initial proposal was fair, and they're the first ones to admit that they can't figure out this Time Warner proposal either.
Amazing. Okay. Bob McChesney, freepress.net, of course, for, you know, a great source of news. And stoppostalratehikes.com, the website, if you want to click through to this and help out. Bob, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure, Tom. Keep up the great work.
You too, Bob. You're doing fabulous work on so many fronts. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Trash in the street, gang graffiti on a boxcar door. We can't make it here anymore.
9.5 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-303-2270. First, the Justice Department. This from the Washington Post. Amit Paley writing about this. I was living in Vermont when Jim Jeffords, the Republican senator and the only Republican that I've ever voted for in my life, the Republican senator decided to leave the Republican Party and become an independent. And the reason he did was because of No Child Left Behind. And I sat with one of his staffers in an office in Vermont, and they shared with me an investigative report that was done by the Congressional Research Service, which is a group that doesn't do research for the public, but will do it for members of Congress, including Mr. Jeffords' office. And I wrote about this in my book, Unequal Protection, the Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights, shared with me this report that showed that the No Child Left Behind law was going to turn the educational testing industry, an industry, by the way, where George W. Bush's brother Neil has a significant interest, was going to turn the educational testing industry from a $100 million a year industry into a multi-billion dollar a year industry. Privatizing testing. When I went to, when I was a kid in the old days, the teacher would write up the test and run it off on the Mimeo machine, and we would take the test. That was it. Right? The tests were in the back of the book, in the teacher's manual of the book, and he or she would make copies of it and pass it. That was it. Now, it's intellectual property, don't you know? They have to buy these tests from these testing companies who are strictly enforcing their copyrights, $5, $10, $15, $20, $25 a test, and then send them off to be graded or buy the machine that's going to be grading them, like some sort of Votematic machine. This has become a multi-billion dollar industry. In fact, they're guessing right now. Well, this is the first sentence of this Washington Post piece. Keep in mind, when Jim Jeffords left the Republican Party in 2002, as I recall, over No Child Left Behind, it was a $100 to $300 million a year industry. $1 billion is $1,000 million. The Justice Department, here's the article. The Justice Department is conducting a probe of a $6 billion reading initiative at the center of President Bush's No Child Left Behind law. Another blow to a program besieged by allegations of financial conflicts of interest and cronyism. Sounds like a criminal enterprise to me, said Congressman George Miller of California, chairman of the House Education Committee. Yeah. Well, see, that's what happens when you put Republicans in charge of the government, because they don't believe in government. They just don't believe in government.
I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
And because they don't believe in government, because they don't believe in the government as having any sort of benevolent or positive or useful force, they only think of it in terms of restraining, of holding back, of having political power, of the police power and the army power, the power of the state to make sure that you're not doing the wrong thing in your bedroom or your living room or on the telephone or in your email or on your computer. Because that's their only vision of what government can do when they're given the reins of government to do things like educate people or build infrastructure or protect cities. They view it as an opportunity to get rich. Because after all, isn't that the highest value in the world? Just ask any Republican. Pat, we were talking before. You had a question
yeah.
about what power we have over the courts.
I think my question is a bit too long for the time we have left. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it was at the time. It was at the time. We have a couple of minutes, but if you could just ask it very quickly, I would appreciate it.
Sure.
What's the question?
Oh, is this Tom Hartman?
It is, and you're on the air.
Oh, Tom, my lifesaver in the sea of misinformation. I am very much interested in what power we the people have over the Supreme Court, which we know is gathering too much power. They've elected a president, and now they tell us that a woman's health is not important enough. If a woman dies or is severely injured because of the decision of the Supreme Court justice in this Roe v. Wade that's going on, what power do we the people have to bring the Supreme Court to account?
We have none. Specifically
none.
For a decision, no, we have none. And this is something that bedeviled Franklin Roosevelt. He had the Supreme Court, as I recall, it was the Lochner Court, the 1905 Lochner decision or 1915 about bread bakeries that struck down minimum wage laws. And it wasn't until 1937 that he was able to get enough good people on the court to go along with it. Basically, the power that we the people have over the Supreme Court is the power to elect a president who will appoint reasonable Supreme Court justices and a Senate who will confirm them. And the problem that we have right now is that we have a president who has put two or three people, I don't recall, on the Supreme Court. I believe it's two people on the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And two right-wing cranks, and we had a right-wing Senate that approved them. And it's just wrong. I mean, but they have immunity from the consequences of their decisions. We can't go after them and say, oh, this woman died and it's your responsibility, unfortunately. And that's one of the reasons, by the way, why the right-wingers were so anxious to put guys in their 50s on the court so that they'll be there
of
for
course.
The next 40 years. So it's a disaster, Pat, and what it means is we have to get involved in electoral politics. Show up at the Democratic Party meetings. Get out there. Participate. Get involved. Coming up on tomorrow's program, Don Goldwater, Barry Goldwater's nephew, has decided to agree with me that we don't have an illegal immigration problem. We have an illegal employer problem. He'll be here to tell you about it. Greg Palast is dropping by with his new book, Armed Madhouse. And as always, the best of the rest of the news, that and your calls here on the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People. And never forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.